Welcome to our session on entitled Considering the Source, Archivists and Educators Partner to Design an Innovative Undergraduate Course in Archival Research Methodology. It's a long title to talk about helping students to appreciate archives and special collections. My name is Carol Bowers. I am the reference manager at the American Heritage Center at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, Wyoming. And our panel is made up of my friends and colleagues from the archives and the university. And so I'd like to begin by introducing all of the speakers prior to their presentations rather than one at a time, just as they present, and then we will go forward with the presentation in the order in which people are seated at the table here. So I'd like to begin by introducing Dr. Carol Bryant. She is Associate Professor of Secondary Education at the University of Wyoming. She received her bachelor's at the University of Northern Colorado and her MA and PhD at the University of Wyoming. She currently teaches classes in social studies, education, and curriculum studies, and has worked with the Partnership for Civic Education, and most recently with the National Endowment for the Humanities to help coordinate. She was one of the main coordinators, along with another of our speakers, for a recent Educators Institute that was held at the American Heritage Center last week and the week before. And her talk will be on the joy of discovery and enhanced understanding educators and archivists give students the key to research memory. So we're going to be talking about how we can inculcate an appreciation and competency in using archives for research today. Our second speaker will be Rick Uick. Rick is Associate Director of the American Heritage Center, the University of Wyoming. During the 14 years that he's been at the American Heritage Center, he's had a number of positions. So he has one of our best institutional memories there. He has been the reference manager, preceded me in that position. He received a master's degree in history at the University of Wyoming, and he is presently editor of Annals of Wyoming, the Wyoming History Journal. Rick is also extremely active in the History Day program, and due to his good offices, we bring in many students each year to the center in connection with History Day. They use our reading room. The IHC is also the headquarters for our State History Day competition, which Rick runs. And Rick's presentation is titled Looking Beyond the Textbook, Archivists as Innovators in Primary Source Education. Our third speaker, last but certainly not least, is Dr. Phil Roberts, Associate Professor of History, the University of Wyoming. He received his bachelor's degree and his Juris Doctorate at the University of Wyoming and his PhD in History at the University of Washington. He teaches the required classes, that survey classes, and they have the constitutional class component that is required. Teaches the largest classes in the College of Arts and Sciences at the university. In addition to those survey classes in Wyoming history, he also teaches classes in American West, American Legal History, and American Environmental History. Prior to coming to the university, he was a historian at the Department of Archives, Museums, and the Historical Department. at the State Archives. He worked in the Northwest Collection at the University of Washington. So he has an archives background as well as a law background, as well as a history background, a teaching background. So quite the expert there. He is also the author of a number of books. One of the most popular things that he puts out periodically is Wyoming Almanac. Tells you everything you ever wanted to know and some things you didn't want to know about Wyoming. He is also a past editor of Annals of Wyoming, the Wyoming History Journal, and is currently chair of the Publications Committee for the State Historical Society. So these will be our speakers this afternoon. I'd just like to say a few quick words about the focus of our session today. And we often encounter, working in a university archive, many students who come to us who have never used an archive, who often have little understanding of research or historical methodology. And we find frequently these students become frustrated or overwhelmed when confronted with assignments that require substantial research in primary document collections. And so the four of us have been teaming for quite a while to try to address this need amongst our undergraduate population. And so what we are doing is we have designed what we hope will be an innovative and multidisciplinary class that will provide students with an introduction to archival administration, the basics of public history, and through the use of primary source materials in our collections, we'll teach students research skills, higher level thinking skills, historical methods, and hopefully encourage them in their analytical and critical thinking, in their ability to develop and test hypotheses based on their historical discoveries. And because many of the students who seem to come in to use the collections, in addition to students in history and English, political science, American studies, we get many students who are teachers in training going out to do their student teaching. And we're hoping that it will really help to enhance their pedagogical methods as they go out into the classroom. And so one of the things that we want to do today is to really stress the importance of for archivists to develop partnerships. If you have students who come in and use your repository, it's very important that you establish partnerships with educators, because it's so much easier to serve your user population if you're partnering in that way. And we want to talk a little bit about what the payoff is, both for the student and the teacher, but also why should you do it? I mean, what's in it for you? It's more work for you. Why should you bother with it? And there's some very good reasons, and I think you'll find in the long haul that it's very rewarding. So with that said, I am going to turn the podium over to Carol Bryant, and at the end we'll save some time and do our best to answer your questions. So thank you.
Thank you, Carol. In my segment of our presentation, I will share some experiences in working with students and teachers in archival settings, then offer insights based on observations and feedback from various classes and workshops, including last week's NEH workshop on women's suffrage on the frontier. Some of what I'll present is anecdotal, some research-based. Some is theoretical, emphasizing the importance of teachers having a background in using primary sources, and some is practical, including concerns that have arisen from my colleagues and me as we worked with educators and students at a variety of levels. And before I go any further, I'd like to just get a sense in this room, how many of you are working with teachers and students at your settings? Okay, good, good. And we'll look forward to hearing some of your comments and insights as we get to the end of the session. I believe that the problem solving, critical thinking, multiple perspectives, and access to information that work with primary sources are critical in the development of thoughtful teachers and students. Furthermore, I think the potential to stir historic imaginations and intellectual curiosity, that makes the joy part of this for me. And if you look at the title of my session, joy seems like an interesting word with archives. And in fact, it's often what we feel when we kind of get the exploring blood pumping. As Carol mentioned, I work with secondary social studies methods in the College of Education. For the past several years, I have asked my students to conduct research at the American Heritage Center to strengthen the historical research skills identified in the National History Standards and to become acquainted with the possibilities of primary sources as classroom teaching tools. The product of the pre-service teacher's work are teaching units that they then take with them when they student teach. When they teach those units, they often provide a resource and perhaps inspiration to their mentor teachers and the students with whom they work. Following one such semester with the students, when the students created primary source teaching units, that we conducted focus groups to assess the value of that experience. Students' responses were audio taped and transcribed. The following quote captures the general sentiment reflected by the students in regard to that week. This quote and the others that follow have been edited to eliminate some of the redundant expressions. Speaking for most, the student reported, "I think that doing primary research is absolutely invaluable. Just because you bring in new and different things that you won't find in the textbook. And textbooks, I don't think, are always reliable in their accuracy." Her contention is supported by Sam Weinberg, professor and author of Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts, whose concern focuses in part on the soundbite organization and didactic presentation of information in most history textbooks. Another student added, "In terms of content, I focused on women on the frontier. And I mean, there was nothing that could replace that because we don't really cover that in our content areas or whatever. And so it just opened my eyes to what was really happening and the role that women did play. And it wasn't just a white European experience. It involved Native Americans and African Americans and Asians. So that was really a bonus to doing primary research. My own experience in working with teachers in a variety of formats, including university courses, grants, and workshops, would seem to indicate the following considerations for more success on their part and less frustration on the part of their facilitators, the archivists. As you know better than others, most people have only the vaguest idea of what archives are and aren't. So it helps new users to know the assets and limitations of the facility, the role it plays, how materials are organized, and what procedures facilitate the work of the user and the archivist. As one of my students, this person was a senior in college, pointed out in her reference to work with the AHC, and I also thought it was really valuable because I didn't know the American Heritage Center had a lot of the stuff that we were looking at. So I thought it was really great in terms of knowing it was more than a museum. Second, allow for time. Weinberg stated that we really don't know how people learn history, but it's reasonable to assume that the process takes time and practice. The importance of time and the encouragement to muck about with history is reiterated by Dr. Cynthia Stokes Brown, professor of education and history at Dominican College. In her comparison between teaching language arts and history, Brown pointed out that while students in the English class read and grapple with multiple meanings of text, teachers in the history class are more apt to tell their students what history means. Students debate the ramifications of current events and political issues, but they seldom explore multiple interpretations of history. Brown argues, only by responding to original material can students begin to expand their imagination about the past and develop their own beliefs about history. Recognizing the need for time, one person reflected, I would like primary sources research expanded from what we did. We should start on day one doing research, I think, so that we can do more interlibrary loan and expand it beyond the American Heritage Center, because they're kind of limited in what they have. And when we read this comment, we have to laugh, because for those of you familiar with that particular center, it's a huge center with a very, very extensive collection. But I'm not sure that it was necessarily a criticism of the American Heritage Center as much as it was that she makes a couple of important points. And one of those is, of course, that research takes time. And second, contrary to frequently expressed user expectations, of which you will no doubt be familiar, few collections contain all the answers, the information to create a complete understanding of a historical problem. A researcher will most likely have to fill in the gaps, identifying other sources, as well as applying an understanding of human nature. Such sophisticated problem solving is complex, even for those versed in historical methods. For educators and students who currently exist in a climate of highly politicized accountability, obsessive in its focus on right answers, and who do not often engage in the processes of historical research, the inconclusive and incomplete evidence, the piecing together of a variety of informational sources, the inevitable gaps in historical sequencing are unfamiliar and unsettling. While persons educated in historical research are adept at processing solutions to a question, teachers are often asking, how can I use this in a classroom? A classroom where coverage of vast amounts of content, test preparation, and a wide range of student abilities are the norm. One of my pre-service teachers captured this concern. I love primary sources, and I think they're the greatest thing, but you have put in so much preparation time into them that you have to allow yourself the time to do that accurately. So that was the one thing that stuck out to me, was that it was so much work and it took so long to organize a primary source unit and to get those objectives down that you have so much other things to do that it would be really hard to prepare to teach with primary documents all the time. Based on this, I want to add as my third consideration, a personal bias. Almost always, the outcome of teacher workshops is the preparation of a teaching unit or lesson plans. While these are practical and seemingly logical expectations, I agree with my former student. Until one can digest the impact and potential meaning of primary sources, until one can put them into a social, political, or cultural context, it may be too early to plug them into lesson plans. Far better for teachers to write personal reflection papers, stories, or other narrative scripts that let them process both the methods and the content of the work they have done. Application can wait to allow for the awakening of interest, curiosity, and possibility, for participants to feel more comfortable with research skills, and for them to make meaning of the materials with which they have worked. No one asks a professional researcher to write the first chapter of her book following a week's introduction to new materials. Teachers, it seems to me, deserve the time and the same intellectual pleasure to think about the new skills and content they've encountered. Most of my students enjoy their work with documents. The same proved true at the recent NEH workshops on women's suffrage that included a day spent touching, reading, feeling document sets. There does seem to be an excitement, a joy in the processes of discovery, in freeing the historical imagination. As one former student wrote, and please note his use of the present tense, when I use it, it'll give them, meaning his students, real life experiences, especially the diaries and memoirs. We had one diary we put in the unit that was from D-Day. And I mean, this guy was talking about the day before. He's not knowing what's going on. And then the next day, he's talking about being there and in the boats. And it was just It made a real life experience, and I know the kids got a chance to get out that information that it's going to make it's going to be a lot more relevant to them in their life. Primary sources research has ups and downs. For me, it is critical to teacher preparation, but so are reading strategies, writing strategies, math strategies, civics lessons, and questioning techniques. In order for my students to be well prepared, it is imperative that they have earlier and prolonged experience with primary sources research. And that's why I feel fortunate that that a class that will allow them time, in-depth exploration of documents and research skills, is now being developed. That class will be discussed in the next portions of our presentation.
Okay, there are still some seats up front, so if those in back would like to be seated, please feel free to do so. Good afternoon, and thank you all for coming. It's wonderful to have such a large room filled today. What I sometimes do when I start a talk is I tell a short story, and so I thought I would do that today. And this was published many years ago in an Eastern newspaper, and then it was picked up later on by a Wyoming newspaper. And it was in the Bighorn County Rustler. And so it deals with an Eastern family, and they are going to head west. And so the night before they're going to head west, the little girl, there are a number of siblings in the family, the little girl kneels down beside her bed and says her prayers. And she blesses her parents and her siblings and others. And then she starts to get into bed, and she thinks, oh no, there's one more thing I want to say in my prayer tonight. So she goes back down on her knees. She folds her hands, and she looks up, and she says, goodbye, God, we're going to Wyoming. Now, I'll let you think about that as to why she might think that Wyoming is a little godless and why we here are glad to be back in the land of the East. But now on to what I was going to talk about today. In my 20-some years of working in the field, I have taught in all of those years. It seems like it's a natural offshoot for what we do in this profession. And from the raised hands before, sounds like many of you believe the same thing. And when I have taught, I have gone into classrooms, fourth grade through 12th grade, around the state of Wyoming. And oftentimes, when I start my presentation, I will ask the question of the students, where does history come from? Now, I'm pretty confident they've never been asked that question before. And usually, I get two responses. Can you guess what they might be? I bet you haven't been asked that before either, have you? What do you think I might get as a response to that question? Books? Mom and Dad? Now, that's very good. That doesn't come off too often, but it comes from Mom and Dad. And who else does it come from?
Television.
Television? True. Teachers is what I usually get. So I get books and I get teachers. And of course, the books are textbooks. And as you heard this morning, textbooks can be boring. I often group those two words together when I talk, and because they truly are. And to me, textbooks don't even capture what history is. It's just facts and dates, and that's not history, and that's not how history should be taught. The other answer was teachers, more or less, because they're in the classroom taking a history class, and it comes from the teacher. So I want to talk about the teacher aspect to this to a degree. When I was first hired by the Archives, Museums, and Historical Department back in 1982, I never thought I would be involved in teaching at all. That never crossed my mind. But what happened was the Wyoming History Day program was being transferred to the state from a community college. And I was the new guy on the block, and they said, he's not going to complain, he's not here yet. We'll just give it to him. And so that's what happened. And so that started my teaching, and I'm so glad that it did. Many of you probably work or have worked with teachers and students in History Day, National History Day. I've been doing this for 20-some years now. And it's been a wonderful experience for me. It's, for those of you who don't know, it's a competition for students in grades 6 through 12. And every year there is a theme. This past year it was taking a stand in history. So you had Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, Jackie Robinson, those topics as you would expect. And next year it will be triumphs and tragedies in history. And then they have to do a paper, a performance, an exhibit, or a documentary based on that theme. And the important part of History Day is that it says you have to use primary sources. So the students at an early age get exposed to primary sources. So it's a wonderful resource in that regard. And they have to do interpretive history. They just cannot write down the facts and the dates that they find in textbooks. They have to do more than what those history textbook writers do. They have to actually do history. And so it's a wonderful opportunity for the students. What I've come to realize dealing with History Day for many years is that the teachers often are inexperienced in knowing what a primary source is, as well as what the historical methods are. They don't have the experience. They haven't been taught that in any way. We try and resolve that to a small degree by doing a History Day workshop for teachers every fall. And usually it falls to me to discuss primary sources. And of course, that can be a little bit difficult. Sources change depending upon how you use them, if they're secondary or primary. But it's clear the teachers have a hard time with those. And so how are they going to teach their students about primary sources? And in fact, what is a primary source? So what I have done the past few years is I've worked up some projects where I come up with an interesting historical topic, at least it is to me, and I then come up with primary sources or secondary sources, and I hand it out, and we go through it one by one. And so they do some reading. We discuss the source. Is it primary? Is it secondary? What does this add to the story? And so 2 years ago, I did one on Frank Hopkins. You might have seen the film Hidalgo, and Disney said it was based on a true story. Well, that begs the question, what's true about it? And of course, nothing is true about it. But beyond that, it gives them a way to explore that and ask the questions that are important. And this past year, I did one on Esther Hobart Morris, who was the first female justice of the peace. And she was supposed to have had a role in the passage of the first suffrage act in the entire country in 1869 in Wyoming. And the question is, what role did she have, if any? So they are then asked to explore these documents and then come to their own conclusions about that topic. And that has been very effective. Although I do find that some teachers, not having the experience with it, they do get a little lost in that, and so you do have to help them through that. Well, once I went over to the American Heritage Center back in 92, there was going to be a big focus on teaching. We were moving to a brand new building. We were part of a university campus. We should do more teaching at all levels. And so Maxine Trost and I don't know if Maxine is here today, came up with a project that we dealt with schools in Rock Springs, Wyoming, three hours west of Laramie. And this was the idea, that we would go out to the classroom in Rock Springs, high school level. We would teach them about secondary sources, how to search online for secondary sources. We would then go back a second time, teach them about primary sources. We would do exercises with them based on primary sources, interpret a photograph, look at different perspectives of the Heart Mountain Relocation Center, a World War II internment camp in northwest Wyoming, and so get them thinking about how to use primary sources. And then they would come to the American Heritage Center and spend 2 days there, afternoon doing research, and then the morning doing research. And then they went back home to Rock Springs, and they did a public presentation then about what they learned. So this was a wonderful experience for us, and I hope for them. But what we found were the students enjoyed doing this kind of research, getting beyond the textbook. They probably enjoyed getting out of the classroom as well, and maybe the teachers enjoyed that too. But we did find too that the students needed more guidance from the teachers. The teachers, when we're in the classroom, they find this as a day off, to be honest with you. They go off and play on the computer. They go off and do other things, and they don't realize it's more for them than it is their students so that they can do it again and again in their classroom in the future. So that's an important lesson here, at least to me. When you want to do this, make sure that the teachers have agreed that they will be engaged so that they then can continue to do this in their classroom in the future. So from my experiences, it is so clear that teachers need to better understand the process of historical research, the use of primary sources, and especially if they are going to design their own projects, which, of course, the hope is they will do that, even though Carol mentioned how time-consuming it can be, at least that's what teachers think. That really is an important goal. So what are we trying to do today, or right now at the university? Well, for many years, since 92, we have taught an archives sequence. It's three classes. First one is the basic areas of archives. Second is a seminar. And then the third is an internship. And Maxine Trost and Tom Wilstead started that back in the early 90s. And we have continued that, doing it as a team teaching for many years. But a few years ago, we wanted to take a step back and discuss, well, maybe how can we reach more students, and how can we incorporate a teaching aspect, since we do a lot of teaching at the American Heritage Center. Carol teaches two or three classes per year, and we have other faculty who teach as well. And so we called a meeting of, Carol was there from the College of Education, the history chair was there, the director of the American Studies program, Mark Green, our director, was there, Carol and I were there as well. And we discussed how we can change this and bring in more students. And so we came up with the idea, as Carol mentioned up front, combining the Archives 1 class with an Historical Research Methods class. And so that's what Carol and I will be teaching in the spring. We're putting it in the spring because Carol Bryan said that fit in better with her students and their line of study. So we are working very closely with the College of Education, which we think, of course, is very important. So what are we going to do in the class? Well, the overall project is going to be a research project based on our collections at the Heritage Center. Of course, we have many collections there, and so students will have to spend at least half the semester, if not more, going through those materials to come up with their result, which will be interpretive. And I will tell them in the first class, you get to do what sixth grade students do in Wyoming History Day. You get to interpret history. And I'm hoping that will shame them into doing a wonderful project. and then at the end, they'll have to do a paper, they can do an exhibit. They can do a PowerPoint presentation. They'll have various options they can choose from to discuss their research project. And we'll discuss, as far as the archival part of that, we'll probably start with that, and we'll just like we do in Archives 1, we'll discuss appraisal, we'll discuss arrangement and description, we'll discuss reference, because these things will inform the research process. So we think that will be an important component to it. So we'll start with those, and then we'll go on to other things as well. We'll look at history through film, and how you in your classroom can interpret history through film. I don't know if any of you have had this experience, but with my students in the Cheyenne School District, too often social studies teachers will put in a film in a history class, and the students watch it, and that's all that happens. There's no discussion of the film, and that's how you teach history? Can you imagine a junior high school student, a junior high school teacher who wants to teach the Vietnam War, and he puts in John Wayne's version of the Vietnam War, the Green Berets? Is that going to be a complete history of Vietnam? I don't think so. And if you've watched the Green Berets, and if you have watched the ending where the sun is setting on the beach as John Wayne and a young boy are walking down the beach, my question is, and the students should ask this as well, how the heck does John Wayne get the sun to set in the east? I'm sorry, I just never have figured that one out. And that would be an important lesson, too, to discuss, it seems to me. So, and we'll do an oral history component as well. But then, and a real important part of this, is going to be some of what I have done in the History Day workshops, where we are going to select subjects on which we have collections at the Heritage Center, and we are then going to break the class up into groups, and they are going to take different sides of these questions, and they're going to have to do the research and then debate, and then we'll have to come to some kind of conclusion as to what really can they determine to be the truth through their own interpretation. And this will be based on primary sources. An example would be Sacagawea. You all have heard of Sacagawea. The question is, in Wyoming and elsewhere, is where is she buried? Some people in Wyoming say that in 1884, she died and she's buried on the reservation in Wyoming. And there's a big marker there on her grave, so it certainly must be the case that she's buried there in Fremont County, Wyoming. Well, some people think that she died 70 years earlier and is buried elsewhere in the West. And we have collections that deal with both sides of that issue. So they are going to really have to do an interpretation and a research study on that topic. And we'll use Frank Hopkins as well. If you ever watch Hidalgo again, keep in mind there's only one thing true in the movie, and that is there is a man named Frank Hopkins. And so I think I will end there, and I'll turn it over to Phil Roberts. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Rick. I was the guy who handed over to Rick back in 1982 History Day, and he did a great job with it. So I'm very, very glad that he was the victim at that particular time. I am going to be talking a little bit today about a course that we have designed, I should say, the American Heritage Center and several of us in the History Department have considered the problem over the years of freshman students coming into the university and not having any understanding, not only of primary documents, but of what an archives is or even how to find it. And the American Heritage Center at the University of Wyoming, for any of you who are familiar with that facility, it looks like a Darth Vader helmet on the edge of the campus. And a lot of people walk by it and have no idea what's in it. They have no idea how to use it. And so in the History of Wyoming survey course that I'm in charge of, I have approximately 260 students in the fall semesters and 125 or so in the spring semesters. I decided that was a very good venue for introducing freshmen to the American Heritage Center and to the holdings in the archives there. The problem was, of course, how do you get a crowd of 260 students from a survey course to an archive and make that experience both meaningful and also protective of the resources that are in the collections? And so what we developed. Actually, Carol Bowers was a very good helper in this and a partner in this in developing a sort of a checklist of what students need to do in order to conduct a research assignment that we developed for the American Heritage Center. So I'm not going to read from this because I only have 4 minutes, according to Rick. So, but what I'm going to do is pass this out as simply an example. And it's a work in progress. As you'll see, I have a green copy, and just take one, but one's green and one's purple, and you can see that one is shorter than the other because it's a work in progress. Every semester, we add some different things, we add some wrinkles, and every bit of it is designed for two purposes. One, to encourage students to use the American Heritage Center, to use the archives, and second, to also be protective of the material that's there. And so I'll pass this out, and then I'll tell you a little bit of on both counts as to what we do to accomplish both of those goals. Start these out down here. Start these out over here. Now, of course, I'm talking about the survey course, so I may as well note one important component of the History of Wyoming survey course. And that important component is a book of readings that I put together a few years ago called Readings in Wyoming History. And it is generated from the mostly, not entirely, but mostly from graduate papers that graduate students in the History Department or in the American Studies Department or in history classes generally, as well as staff from the American Heritage Center, have written over the years. And it is designed as a book of readings for the survey course, but it also has a very, very important lesson built in it. And that is, look, these primary source materials that you're going to be looking at have a use, and they can help interpret the story of Wyoming history. And here is an example in the very book that you're using for this course. Here are live people who use these archives to put together these stories that are important in telling the history and the stories of our state. I'm just going to pass this around. I'm not trying to push the book because it's simply one that we publish within the History Department as simply a course book. It's not something that is widely distributed or anything of that sort. In essence, what we're doing in this exercise is teaching both process and product. Process, as you can see from the handout that I just distributed, process is telling students just the fundamentals. How do you get to the building? What do you do when you get there? And that's where the archivists come in. That's where Carol and her staff come in, is that they conduct an hour's orientation of 20 students at a time. Those 20 students go during a class hour, unfortunately, because we haven't figured out how to get around that problem yet, because there's just not enough hours in an academic calendar to be able to get special time set aside for that course for 20 people at a time. But they go during assigned times. It's usually designed alphabetically, A through C, maybe one day, and the next day another group. But they are then given an assigned collection to look at. And Carol and her staff make the assignment. They say, okay, number one, this particular collection is Johnny's, and this one's Mary's, and the next one is somebody else's. And each person is given an individual collection to look at. Now, they're given all of this information in the orientation, but they can't sit down at that point and carry through with this exercise, because that would defeat part of the process part of the exercise. Part of the process part of the exercise is to be able to go into the archives, sign in, do all the things that are necessary in order to call up the collection box, look in the inventory, find out what box they want to call up, and go through all those processes that will make them more comfortable the next time they use that facility. And by the way, that's a very important goal of this, is to make it possible for those students as they grow in their academic career to feel more comfortable about using the archives. It's not this strange Darth Vader helmet. It's actually a place where I can find something that will be of some value in other courses, in other papers, whether it be in history or whether it be in lots of other fields. And the important thing about the process as well is for the archivist to be able to explain to students the value of these materials as one-of-a-kind primary sources, the care necessary in treating these materials, and the fact that we know who's using them, so you better be careful. It's all sort of implied in the way those assignments are made. It's also very beneficial to the collection itself, because there's a maximum of one student per semester per collection that's using the materials. That's not going to be extraordinarily difficult on that archive. If you were to have 260 students all using one collection, it would be very, very difficult, first of all, logistically, to pull it off, but also it would be very, very hard on those collections, on those documents. And so the goal is for individuals to be able to see documents up close, touch them, original primary sources, not online. There's something you lose, I contend, when you look at things online. But they have the opportunity to look at these items that have been written or been compiled by people in history. And then they're asked a series of questions. And the new, improved, revised edition requires that they do a 5 to 7 page piece that includes answers to a number of questions, not just the process of getting to the collections, but what do these things mean? These items that you've drawn from this collection, from this particular box in this collection, what kind of story does this tell you about our history? And students, of course, are expected to have a little bit of context. And that context lies in not just in the readings in Wyoming history, the book that they're reading for the class, but also from the lectures and the discussion sections in that particular freshman survey class. I contend that product includes context, and one of the important things that we are providing as instructors at the university is that context, where they can understand where those primary documents might fit in their broader education of history. So that, in a nutshell, is what it does for students at the survey level. And I'm not going to talk about using it at the upper division or graduate level, but in all of my classes, I have students utilizing the collections in the American Heritage Center. And of course, as it increases in from freshman to graduate student, it increases in analytical expectations and writing expectations as we go up. Graduate seminars, the goal of the graduate seminars is to be able to produce, for graduate students to be able to produce a publishable paper that may appear in Annals of Wyoming that Rick edits, or which is a refereed scholarly journal of Wyoming history, or eventually to show up on the pages of a future edition of Readings in Wyoming History, something that future students will be able to then look at and be inspired by and hopefully enjoy the opportunity to look at the materials that went into the creation of a reader such as this. What's in it for the archivists? And I often feel a little guilty sending 260 people over to Carol and her staff that have all these researchers coming in from all over the country to use all of these collections, and they're like, is there any archive that's not understaffed and underfunded? I just don't know if that there is. But to be able to give to the American Heritage Center at least some credit for the stuff that they do, what is there beyond that? And I've borrowed from this morning's speaker two of those items. Cokie Roberts, by the way, is no relation to me, but us Robertses, boy, we're taking over the country these days, you know. Supreme Court justices and all kinds of stuff. And I don't think any of us are related. But anyway, two of those things are future advocates. And in the case of the History of Wyoming course, I'm a little bit ambivalent to say this, but I've been at the University of Wyoming now this time since 1990, and already there are several of my former students in these classes who now serve as legislators in the Wyoming legislature. And those folks obviously have at least an introduction to the importance of the American Heritage Center and an introduction to the value of primary sources. Those people are individuals that we can draw on for support in those necessary times that every one of our Archives has over the years to gain the necessary funds and the necessary staffing to keep us operating. And the other aspect that was mentioned this morning that that I think is important to archivists is the satisfaction of providing that accommodation, to accommodate the scholarly community, not just at the top level of the authors of the books and the top scholars in the field, but those who aspire to that, or those who will be our future parents and ultimately those people who will be teaching those students that that Rick mentioned. Parents, teachers, those are the things where history comes from. So advocates can be built this way. Certainly a sort of a built-in lobbying operation can be built in getting first-year students into a course or into an archive like this. And incidentally, 90% of the students who take the Wyoming history class are not history majors. We hope that a few of them get enticed into the field because we all know how lucrative it is, right? But 90% of them aren't history majors, and really it's not intended for us to try to encourage people to become history majors, but to appreciate the breadth of the collections, to appreciate the breadth of the primary materials that can be used for a wide variety of fields as these people move on to their professional careers. So I think my 4 minutes is up, Rick.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to open up the floor for questions in just a moment, but one thing that I neglected to mention during our the introduction of our panelists is that Phil, due to his combination of degrees in history and in law, has had the chance to visit archives in many parts of the world, which kind of gives him an unusual perspective that many of us don't get on how archives work in the United States versus other places. Most recently, he was assisting with setting up law schools in Baku, and I guess you had an opportunity to visit archives there,
I'm guessing,
and in Egypt and in other parts of the world. And so I did have a question there. Are they doing educational kinds of things in other countries as far as bringing students in those archives?
They are, but I've got a story.
Oh, okay, then I'll send
that. Is that okay to tell
that's
a story?
Okay.
Okay, a really quick one. This is really fast. Okay, this is really fast.
I was looking during the course of my research that I was working on in the history of oil and the development of oil in the Arab Middle East and in the American West. I was doing a comparative look at these two places. And I happened to be over in England, so I looked in the public records over there for concession agreements that were made between the oil companies and the sheikdoms and the other areas of the Middle East, Arab Middle East, in the 1930s, and I couldn't find anything. So I went down to the National Library of Abu Dhabi and looked through there, and nothing there. And I looked at other collections in the Emirates and around the region, Kuwait and Bahrain back many years ago, nothing. One day I was back at the University of Wyoming and I was in the American Heritage Center waiting for a box to be pulled up from the collections for something that had no relationship whatsoever to this project. And I thought, well, I wonder if there's anything here that would help. And I entered it into the little data entry thing, push the button. Bingo, there's the Thomas Ward papers, oil concessions for Kuwait, 1934. Right there in the collection, a half a mile from my office. I don't like to tell students that story except as a warning. Start at home before you go somewhere else. Thanks, Carol.
So there are many things that students can discover, and I think one of the big payoffs for us is to help this next generation coming up develop an appreciation for archives, because they'll be the ones who are helping to have those collections preserved and providing the funding and other things for that. So that's a goal that we hope will continue, and also to improve classrooms around the country. So these are things that all of you can do. Let me take the remaining time to ask for questions from the floor. Yes, sir.
Let me ask a question.
Under this kind of circumstance, what we have run into, here's what this entails. Should I come up there and answer?
Okay, either might work.
Okay, this is something that we learned through the school of hard knocks, of students turning in papers written by colleagues the previous year. And the reason we put that on there is simply to indicate to students that, in point of fact, those assignments of those collections will be noted by the archivist for that individual checking out those particular boxes. It is designed for two reasons. One, to avoid the plagiarism issue, and number two, to provide to the American Heritage Center at least some tracking of what's going on with this particular introductory class. So it's in pure form, you're correct, in the pure form it would be a violation, in the pure form, but it is utilized in this particular case as a pedagogical tool to avoid plagiarism and avoid borrowing on the part of a lot of different students using the same thing, fraternity files, sorority files, things of that sort. We certainly don't imply in any way that future uses of these materials would become known to us. That's certainly not the intent, and it's certainly not even by implication what we're suggesting here. It's simply to monitor 260 students all using the American Heritage Center in one semester. So I hope that's a satisfactory answer.
Well, again,
it's the nature of the assigned exercise. We're not looking at the. Let me put it this way. We have one collection per person, 260 separate collections used in one semester. We don't expect to obtain 259 reports of different collections and one report that duplicates one of the others. And that's why we use this particular procedure. Notice is provided right here. This constitutes in this respect, it constitutes part of the contract, if you will, in the syllabus for the course. And if that's subject to litigation, we'll just see what happens. Yeah, and it's the same as we do. I do this commonly with extra credit exercises, which I don't like to do, but sometimes students and also visiting scholars feel that an audience would be nice to have, including some students that would be able to take advantage of the opportunity to hear the scholar, and I'll have sign-up sheets for that they actually attended. Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? Yes. Okay, question. Let me just speak to this just a quick, sure. And then let you come in. Question was, how much work do we do to let students know that they can find primary sources outside the American Heritage Center? And actually, we teach at the Heritage Center about 150 bibliographic classes per academic year, and that is a component of that bibliographic class. In the public history classes and some of the others, and Phil and Rick may want to speak to this as well, we also make it a point to tour students often to the state archives, sometimes to archives in Colorado that are nearby, to let them know about resources in the community. And one of the things that I require in my public history class is a broad search for, so they can't use just stuff from one repository. So we're trying to get them out to know, when you're looking at the problem broadly, where do I look so that I can get the most comprehensive amount of material. Do either of you want to
In response to that as well, the survey course, it's simply a case of logistics. The American Heritage Center is close by, and logistically we utilize that as a typical archive. In the upper division courses and in the graduate level courses, of course, we always take into account our close proximity to the National Archives, the Denver branch, and as well as the State Archives in Cheyenne, and various small local depositories that occasionally will have very unique items, very important items that can lend themselves to a study. I think in some of those articles in the Readings in Wyoming History book that's being passed around, you'll note that there's some archival materials found in some pretty tiny collections that are included as important to the writing of some of those articles.
And just quickly, when we do Wyoming History Day workshops for teachers or for students when we're in the classroom, we always have handouts for them for other places that they can go to, because the History Day topics can be national, can be worldwide, and so we want them to realize that there's more than just Wyoming. We love Wyoming topics, of course, but we do want to encourage them to find primary sources elsewhere, too.
And there was one question back here. I need to take this one question. We run into that problem, too. And so we do some collaboration. I'll let others speak to this. But as reference manager, if an instructor wants to send a class over to the center, we require that they meet with the archivist in advance, that they do some of their own work and preparation. Frankly, we don't have time to do the lesson plans for the instructors. Now, that said, we're always happy to work with them to understand their interests and try to direct them to materials that will suit their needs. We had an instructor in the history department that developed an entire class based on collections of Asia through American eyes. And, you know, he worked as hard as anyone could possibly work to develop that entire class. Phil certainly does that. Carol Bryant does that. But sometimes, too, we have instructors that are coming in that aren't familiar with the process, and so they do need our guidance. But this is not drop off 80 kids and go to coffee and we'll deal with it. We don't do that. So, yes.
And I would just add that it's really highly interpersonal. It's really, really difficult to deal with academics. I know having been in an academic department, it's often difficult to deal with academics. And I would just say to you that certainly there's going to be someone that is going to, in your history department or in one of the departments in your college, there's going to be someone that's going to have an appreciation for archives, will have formerly worked there, or will have some other appreciation for it and the amount of work that you all go into when you have a class coming in, and latch on to that person and build the collaborative opportunity there, and then you can shame perhaps some of the other academics into following that particular template.
Okay. I want to thank you all for coming. We have another session in this room, so thank you. If you have any additional questions, we'll be around for a few minutes and try to take them individually.
And feel free to email me, too, about any of this.